thing was, this kind of reminds me of Native Son, and I hadn't watched the movie in so long. I wasn't trying to be better than you.
Native Son. I never finished the book.
You're not missing much. Let me tell you how it ends.
Sure. Sure, spoiler.
He goes to New York and realizes that the pizza and the bagels are overrated.
Wow. That is the worst ending ever.
Well, that's what Richard Wright wanted. He wanted the world to know that you people do not have superior pizza and bagels.
Horrible.
But you do have superior schmears for your bagels. I will give you that.
It all goes together.
But the bagels themselves are not that amazing.
You're wrong about that.
You know what? Let's take a poll.
Yeah, you take your poll. You take your poll. And we'll see what you find. Because we all know the truth.
Hey!
It's the water in New York that makes the food taste so good.
Well, we'll find out soon enough. Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Before we start, if you're new to the channel, please hit like, subscribe. Don't forget to hit that notification bell because we are constantly adding new shows and doing cross streams with other channels. As you might have heard on the cold open, MT is back. I have my faceless comrade in crime and slime to keep the show on track. Back with us today, but you know, as a New Yorker, she sadly believes that they have superior pizza and bagels for some reason. I don't get it. But if you disagree and think that New York is the superior pizza and bagel place, please leave a comment in this. I want to hear what you guys have to say about what region has the superior pizza. Everyone in those places, New York and Jersey and where else, Tucson, do you guys have an opinion on pizza? For some reason, Connecticut. I'm a Californian, we just don't care. Also, just want to let you guys know that this is the final week of fundraising for the feature length documentary on the way we consume media, Kayfabe. There should be links in the chat being posted by our wonderful moderators and MT. And there should be a QR code above my head you can scan. If you would like to be a part of the movie, we're doing something really cool. And at certain donation levels, you can do a wrestling promo that we are going to play a montage of at the end of the movie. I'm kind of excited to get those in and finish that up. Also, we have a great week of shows ahead tomorrow. I got Wild Bill Cody and Mac McGinnis on to talk about the Paul Blair, the brothers. Sorry, they are a massive draw, but is that good for the sport of boxing and sports in general? Thursday, we'll be speaking with filmmaker Stephen DeCastro about his time in a radical Maoist sect in the Philippines, the documentary he made about it. And then Saturday, we'll have on columnist Arun Gupta on to talk about his new column in Descent Magazine, where he discusses food and ethical consumption and more. So, like I said, it's a very busy week. All those shows are up, so you can set reminders so you're alerted every time they go live. So, I want to send a massive shout out to all that do subscribe on YouTube and Twitch. And of course, everyone that subscribes on the audio only formats as well. You guys are the fuel and the TIR machine that keeps us going. If you would like access to the patron only champagne room where we're going tonight. If you would like to be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour. It's going to be a good one this month. I can't tell you exactly. It's going to be about, me and Pascal talked about it already. Very excited for that. If you want to join us for movie nights, there's only one way. Become a patron for as little as $2 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. Now that we got all that out of the way, let me bring in the faceless voice of reason, M. Toussaint.
Hello, hello. Everybody is a different kind of Barbie now. And I'd have to say you are wrong, Barbie. Your opinions on pizza and bagels. Just wrong.
I think I was talking to you where yesterday I was outside at a cafe that I frequent here in downtown Rosarito, and there was like a family from visiting from across the border, and the Mexican family, and they had a little girl with them, and she had a black Barbie. And I had never seen anyone that wasn't black play with a black Barbie. And I had to ask, I was like, is that a black Barbie or some sort of new Puerto Rican one? And they were like, oh no, it's a black one. And she picked it out. They really wanted to let me know. And she picked it out. I was like, ooh. So did you have a black Barbie growing up?
I did. I had a cultural cross-section of Barbies.
Because that's the neighborhood you grew up, looked like Sesame Street, or why?
I thought it was best. My cousins were very Afrocentric, and they made sure that their daughters only had black Barbies. But I was like, that's not the world we live in. Get real. So I wanted one of every Barbie.
I remember trying to buy my daughter a Barbie. She couldn't have been more than like 3 or 4, and I was torn because I was like, but it's so much darker than her. Like, it's not an accurate depiction, and she's got blue eyes. This isn't what she looks like. This is like Iman Barbie. Yeah. I did finally find her a Barbie that's closer, but she still kind of makes fun of me about it.
I'm sure she appreciated it.
She still has it.
I got Barbies late because my parents are Haitian and they didn't understand.
Why there was no Haitian Barbie?
Well, they didn't understand why a kid would want to play with a grown woman and not and not a baby. Not a baby doll. If you think about it, it is kind of weird. And my dad would always say, you want a Barbie doll? I don't understand. This is a grown woman. Why don't you go play with your mother? And I'd be like, no.
Every time I hear your parents talk, sadly, I just hear Dave from Jamaica speak, because I assume all you island people talk the same. No. Want their Barbie now? A girl is a grown woman. There, booyaka, booyaka. I'm sure that's not at all how they sounded, but in my mind, that's the way that all of you people sound. Another episode of ADOS Jason coming at you.
ADOS Jason.
But I think your parents are actually onto something with the whole playing with the girl. I've never thought of that before in my life.
Yeah, it is a little strange.
No comment. Today's show, Cultural Capital and Cold Hard Cash. There was a time not long ago where the elites of society looked and talked differently from the rest of us. Their style and sophistication was a cultural marker of class and success. And these things couldn't be impersonated. They were inherited. Now, you can't quite tell the difference between wealthy and poor, and some feel that this is a good thing. The distribution of cultural capital is a path to creating a more egalitarian society. But our guest tonight says, not so fast! From her recent book review in Jacobin titled Cultural Capital is No Substitute for Cold Hard Cash, Giselle writes, these days it's easier than ever to affect a high status look, with elites jettisoning exclusive markers of quote good taste for a more liberal, pluralistic conception of beauty and authenticity, not to mention a spate of speedy manufacturers gamely mimicking everything from Balenciaga handbags to Supreme hoodies at affordable prices. Side note, I'm really glad I was able to say Balenciaga. The task of affecting privilege has lost some of the difficulty that made Highsmith's drama so compelling. As W. David Marks argues in his book, Status and Culture, How Our Desire for Social Rank Creates Taste, Identity, Art, Fashion, and Constant Change, the rise of digital culture and the democratization of taste have diluted the potency of traditional class signals, physical mannerisms, refined elocution, knowledge of rarefied music and art, and proper manners. But the absence of overt snobbery and exclusive know-how hasn't disappeared status rankings altogether. Instead, it's made them more contingent on actual money. This is an excerpt from Cultural Capital is No Substitute for Cold Hard Cash. Wherever you are listening to or watching this show, there are links in the description. Our guest, Eileen Giselle, is a poet and critic with recent contributions to The Baffler, Current Affairs, Hyperallergenic, and The Hopkins Review, among other publications. She's a 2023 winner of the Rabkin Foundation Prize in Arts and Journalism and teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. Please welcome Eileen Giselle.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I want to get back to talking about Barbies. I'm going to try to find a way about cultural capital and class, Lasso wins and Barbies. I've got a lot of good Barbie stories.
Do you have black Barbies?
That's the thing. I had almost exclusively black Barbie.
Is it because your parents were trying to teach you a lesson, or
my parents, my mom forbade us from having Barbies, and then what happened is that I have three younger sisters. They started to trickle in from relatives.
Where, who are your relatives?
Like they would give, like for example, my godfather gave me my first Barbie, who is Teresa, who's brunette. Mm-hmm. I got like idol Teresa when I was six, and once the Barbie started trickling in, my mom was like, okay, this is a unreasonable beauty standard, this isn't good, so what I'm gonna do is promote black beauty and basically all black Barbies. I also suspect though that she had other much less virtuous motivations. I think that the black Barbies went on sale faster. As fuck. Can we curse?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I should have asked that, but yeah, my mom is very, very frugal. So I don't know if part of the reason we had such united colors of Benetton ensemble of Barbies was because of maybe my mom finding them on clearance, because that was often where we would get toys. So yeah.
That's hilarious.
I'd like to think that my mom had really just like wholesome, you know, like she was a big proponent of like Missouri had like one of the first black Miss Americas. I think her name was Debbie Johnson, I think. And then Debbie Thomas was the black figure skater.
Oh, she's from St. Louis?
No, the figure skater was. But the Miss America was like Miss Missouri was, you know. And so I don't know, throughout the 80s and early 90s, there were these different, I don't know, FloJo. We had a FloJo doll and Barbie.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm trying to think your mom was fighting all the discount toys. Is there a Dollar General in your neighborhood? Because this sounds like some Big Lots / Dollar General.
Well, my mom is a big proponent of Big Lots, or at least was. I don't know if Big Lots is still around anymore. But when Big Lots first started, you know, taking over suburban America, and you know, she was a proponent for sure.
You had hella discount Barbie shit, like the Barbie Prius. Barbie Mazda.
We did have stuff though that wasn't really practical. Like we wanted a Barbie house. We wanted the basic needs for Barbie, like housing.
You didn't get any of that. You got a Barbie room for rent.
Yes, where we had I remember thinking, if we can't have a house, let's get a mobile home because at least she has a place to live. But we didn't have the dream mobile home either. So we had our Barbies. Like my dad built a Barbie church because we were a very Catholic family.
Wow.
They lived in the church. The Barbies lived in the church. And so we had to find narrative context for their interactions to justify the fact that they were living in a church. And often the narratives we came up with had to do with war or something really dramatic where no one has a place to live and they're just sheltering in a church. I mean, it made weddings very convenient.
But the thing is that you've created a black church for your black Barbies. What's most funny is
that's hilarious.
In my mind, I'm seeing these white children with Barbie shouting in the pew, just in the aisles and
on the altar.
Barbie speaking in tongues.
Ken and Barbie in the church choir area, because that was where they slept. Their little feet would stick out because they were too big for the choir area that was up the stairs. But they had their little erotic space there.
Sister act ass Barbie. Mama, I want to get a Mahalia Jackson record for my black Barbie church.
Mahalia Jackson.
Oh, we did not have that.
I'm sorry. I watched all this white cinema class. For this show.
It's a good segue to talking about class.
I watched. So I reread the article again last night, and then I watched Gattaca, actually.
Oh yeah.
Because reading the article, I thought, I don't want to watch The Talented Mr. Ripley. But I remember Gattaca, which also has Jude Law, and that was kind of a similar story of. Different in the context heuristic society where you can imagine futures of your child, and if you have your child naturally, then you're relegated to a lower status in life in general. You'll never be able to get certain jobs or whatever. And then, the guy masquerades as Jude Law, which Talented Mr. Ripley, similar story. Jason Bourne, what's his name again?
Matt Damon
masquerades as Jude Law and of course kills him and kills a bunch of other people. But I have to ask the question, is Talented Mr. Ripley kind of a white version of Native Son? Because it reminded me a lot of the Bigger Thomas character.
That's so interesting. Full disclosure, I have not read the Richard Wright novel, so I can't speak to this in any
context. That's fine. Nobody really has.
I actually got it mixed up with James Baldwin's Notes from a Native Son, because I did read that way back in college. Mm-hmm. And I do like a lot of Baldwin's writing. I don't know Richard Wright's writing as well. My understanding of, Patricia Highsmith wrote the novel.
Mm-hmm. In the 50s.
Yeah, the movie was based on. And I actually had the idea, Jason, for this piece that I wanted to write long before I actually saw Talented Mr. Ripley. I knew what it was, but I hadn't actually seen the whole movie. And then when I rewatched it, when I really watched the whole thing for the first time, back in May, I thought, okay, this movie dovetails with all sorts of things going on in the W. David Marks book. So I knew I wanted to write in the W. David Marks book because I thought it was a really interesting book. And I agreed with 90% of it. But then I felt the 10% I didn't agree with was actually the most interesting as far as how it related to my own life. So, I wish I could do more in the Richard Wright vein. Why don't you tell us why it reminds you of Native Son?
I think you have a similar story of someone that kind of accidentally finds themselves in an entirely new element. I mean, the talented Mr. Ripley, Matt Damon's character, is kind of accidentally vaulted into high society. He does work at Princeton as a piano tuner, I think, and then he was a bathroom attendant at a high-end theater. But he's not really in these places in a comfortable setting. When you're the help, it feels different. I don't know if you've ever been there. I know you say in your piece you actually worked at a high-end restaurant. It's a very different feeling when you're picking up things for people opposed to when there's an arm around you and they're talking to you as if you're an equal. And for those that don't know the movie, I know maybe some of our younger viewers haven't watched it, because I don't know, and I wanted to ask you this too. Do you think that movie is a little too unrelatable, you know, to your point about your piece, because we don't really see wealthy people in that same light like we did with the talented Mr. Ripley, where they literally have a different language that they speak, food that they eat, mannerisms, the way they dress. Like, he had to do so much to try to fit in.
I feel like, so in a way, so it was what was disturbing watching it is that, like, in a way, I actually identified with Ripley, who's in some ways a really sympathetic character, but in other ways, of course, it's not. And I'm seeing like comments like, no spoilers for the movie.
It's 20 years old. If you haven't seen it now, F you. It ends. He kills everybody.
I think that what I thought was interesting and disturbing at the same time was how much I identified with Ripley. So there's one level at which I think that this idea of assimilation, or seeming like you understand the codes, or seeming like you understand the references, kind of pretending, and then the better you pretend, the more easily accepted or embraced you are by a group that, in terms of economic class, you don't belong to. That was something I felt like I really related to personally. And so it was fascinating to me that on one level, okay, no, like, we don't have these conspicuous codes that demarcate, like, the 1% from the top 10%, from the top 20%, because so many people dress in a way and comport themselves in a way that is much less conspicuously class-based. So, like going to the opera or listening to classical music, or, you know, wearing, like, designer clothing doesn't necessarily mean that you are from one class versus another. I mean, I do think there are codes today that are less conspicuous, or that are actually harder to see, that help distinguish between different economic classes, but nothing as entrenched as what you're pointing out in Talented Mr. Ripley. And, you know, it's set during like mid-20th century. Yeah. So what I thought was interesting about the movie is how much I like related to it in terms of like pretending and like performing a certain class level. And I think part of that, I mean, you mentioned waiting tables, but I really feel like beyond waiting tables, I also felt like I was doing that in graduate school. I still feel like I'm doing that sometimes as a faculty member at one of the richest undergraduate institutions in the country. Most of my students just don't have the same kind of class background as I do. So there's a way in which if you're one of the few people who is not from wealth, you do kind of have to pretend to a certain extent, even if, you know, even if the semiotics or the markers, the visual markers or the verbal markers may not be as obvious. So that was one of the reasons why I kind of tied it in, is because I felt like, okay, yes, it's very different. Like, today's situation with class signifying is very different than it was back then. But then at the same time, the fact that I still sympathize with this guy at all is, I don't know, alarming, but fascinating as well. it's supposed to be sympathetic.
It's a sympathetic character. You can say the same for Gattaca to some degree, probably, depending on if you watched. I know they remade Native Son a few years ago, and there's things that were taken out of both movie versions, I think, that are in the book where he kills his girlfriend in the book. So, you know, they took that out for whatever reason. And you never read Native Son, right, Toussaint?
I started it, but
just to make me feel better.
And you were like, "F this guy, I don't give a damn."
I didn't like the way he was treated. Like, the writer didn't like his own character, and I was just really turned off.
Oh, James Baldwin, I think he was a little bit not a fan of the main protagonist of Son. Like, he was. I mean, I haven't read it, but. And also, I feel like I'm not the person to ask if if bigger is a stereotype. Probably, I mean, I think I'm a good reader, but I feel like I wouldn't be an authority on 1930s, 1940s stereotypical representation.
That's not what you're teaching? Jesus.
I mean, I would like to think I could spot a stereotype, but I also feel like I would never claim to be an authority on that.
Oh, I mean, again, there was a lot of Black people that had problems with that book, so don't act like it was a unified yes. Negroes? Mm-hmm. It wasn't, that wasn't what happened.
We're all Native sons here.
But, you know, rewatching Talented Mr. Ripley, it is an interesting case study of someone constantly watching from the outside in. I mean, these things have happened in real life where there's been people that have, like, you know, the Central Park murderer.
Yes.
In 1988, because I know it's before the Central Park Five. he's not of the same financial status as the people he was going to Choate and all those other schools with. And he ends up killing a woman. He had robbed a bunch of people. He was kind of like a horrible dude. But he was adjacent to that level of privilege. And you kind of wonder if the Talented Mr. Ripley is kind of a nicer portrayal of someone like that.
I mean, Matt Damon also, I will say, I really like a lot of early Matt Damon. And what I really like about Talented Mr. Ripley is that, and also Jude Law in general, because this also happened with Gattaca. You just saw Gattaca. So Jude Law is so perfect looking. Mm. But if you put any other really good looking actor like Ethan Hawke or Matt Damon next to him, all of a sudden he's like homely. You see what I'm saying? Like, he's the human, but, you know, Jude Law is the beautiful specimen. He's like, you know, in Gattaca, they're genetically enhanced, you know. And somehow it's believable that Ethan Hawke is like, no, he's not genetically enhanced. Look at his teeth. They're not perfect. And, you know what I mean? And then, like, with Matt Damon, the same thing happens because Matt Damon is also like a, you know, he's a good looking guy, but next to Jude Law, all of a sudden it's like, oh, this guy's, he's too shabby, you know? And so I think that the movie takes advantage of that in some really interesting ways. And Matt Damon is, I think he does a really good job in the role. And I think the fact that he's also a queer character and like is kind of in love with Dickie also complicates matters, but it's still gruesome what happens. Like, it's a violent movie.
Very dark. It's a dark film, right?
It totally is. So, I mean, I just took that as a jumping off point because I figured a lot of people might be familiar with it and it would be a good thing to contrast with today where it seems like we're kind of knocking down all of these conspicuous symbols of wealth. And in some ways, I think, you know, that's true. But on the other hand, I agreed with W. David Marks that when cultural capital isn't worth as much, status doesn't disappear. It just means that actual money makes a big difference. That dog howling is not my dog, by the way.
We can't hear it.
Okay.
The only thing I'm worried about is where howling
2 doors down, and her name is Athena. And I feel so bad that a dog with such a strong name.
Hell of a name for a dog. I'm not worried about any dog noises. I'm just worried about Hannibal Lecter's basement, which you seem to be broadcasting from.
This is a little sunroom that's like attached to the back of my 105-year-old house. Mm-hmm. And it's the one space that's like kind of separate from the rest of the house. So I don't have like an office. So this is my little my little space. I interviewed a German filmmaker and he was like, why are you in jail? I was zooming with Christian Petzold. He's like, why are you in jail? And I was like, I guess maybe from a feminist perspective, like the home is a prison.
If you said that, you're the funniest person alive.
I did not say that. I thought of that like 15 minutes after.
And if he talked to you like the Count in Sesame Street, that's also equally as funny. I do want to. I'm just hoping that there's not a basket that falls down. You just start talking and putting lotion on, like, yeah, and I think David Marks' portrayal of and there you go. I do.
Oh, people are calling this a solarium. Oh, I should use that word. That's a bougier word. It's a solarium.
Only the finest insults here at TIR. But back on topic, what does David Marks get wrong in class analysis? And why is it important that we recognize this error and go deeper into the analysis?
So towards the end of his book, he starts to gesture towards the ways in which marginalized people and poor people getting more respect or like being treated better because of the fact that snobbery is not the reason that they are, I guess, treated badly. Like in a less snobby society, that people will be treated better and this will actually like make their lives better. I mean, I quoted a part that I especially took issue with, and that was a part where he talks about the rise of hip hop and how the rise of hip hop, you know, arguably benefited marginalized communities and benefited the Black community. And I was kind of thinking, I don't think that that's like broadly true in terms of like,
you're right to think that.
Benefits. Yeah. I think that that's false. And I felt like it was an example of like being too valedictory about the benefits of cultural capital. So like, I remember it, you know, in my teens, like the rise of hip hop in the 90s. I definitely have seen my students' interest in hip hop, you know, expand.
Do you know Nelly?
But
do you know Nelly? Don't try to run from that.
Do I know Nelly? Oh yes. No, I don't. But I was very proud that like for a while when I told people I was from St. Louis, they'd be like, oh, Nelly's from there. And I was like, yeah. And like he showed, you know, in his video, he actually showed a lot of parts of St. Louis I know really well. So that felt good.
He showed a lot of parts, period.
But actually Nelly's a great example of how like hip hop prosperity does not necessarily bring economic prosperity, because Nelly, I think, has gone bankrupt. And like he started some kind of music institute or some kind of education program and doesn't exist now either. So, but in St. Louis, you know, recognition for Nelly or recognition of the hip hop scene in St. Louis, which has been here for a long time. I mean, I think that's a good thing. I think cultural capital can be a very good thing, but I don't think cultural capital translates into economic gains for marginalized people. In this case, we're talking about marginalized people who are largely Black, okay, with hip hop. But I feel like in general, I think cultural capital is important, but I think he overvalues it a bit in terms of the implications of having it or not having it. So, yeah, I think it was really, and what I thought was interesting about it is that in some ways, W. David Marks overestimates the extent to which cultural capital could lead to upward mobility. I think he does, at least a few times gesture to that it could do that. And for me, I feel like I grew up totally thinking that cultural capital was my ticket out in a way, that like if I just learned the right things and dressed the right way and spoke in the right accent and traveled to the right places, that I would be able to assimilate into the upper echelons and that my life would kind of, I would belong to that class. And I realized that's not true. Like, even if you can assimilate into those groups culturally, if you can't, you know, afford housing, if you can't afford healthcare, you know, you can discuss Proust all you want, but it's not going to pay for, you know, it's not going to pay for birth control. It's not going to pay for going to the doctor if you have something wrong with you. So especially when I started getting older, I started realizing like, okay, this is not something that, this is something that I overestimated. So I use the W. David Marks book or the review of the book. It's kind of a jumping off place to think about how I overestimated the extent to which cultural capital could be exchanged for upward mobility. And there are other things in my life that actually contributed much more to economic security that had nothing to do with cultural capital. It had nothing to do with like what books I'd read or what art I'd seen or anything like that. So I will stop talking now.
No, you're literally here to talk. Toussaint, I know you have a question in regards to the hip hop. Do you want to?
I do. I thought it was interesting that in the piece, you mentioned that in the book that hip hop is a $1 billion industry. And that made me think immediately of Jay-Z.
Oh, yeah.
Jay-Z is a billionaire now. And a lot of hay has been made of the fact that he He doesn't wear chains anymore, and he doesn't wear logos.
Yeah, yeah.
He looks more like a regular guy than ever.
Yes.
And at the same time, he's got this ridiculous Basquiat referring hairdo that I think he is using as a status symbol.
Well, it rewards people who know, who recognize it.
Right. I think it's also sort of like, you know, you plebs, you get in trouble at work for having your hair a certain way, but I get to do this where I am.
Oh, I financially freed myself. It's the lamest shit ever because, like, let's be honest. These are, like, pop artists from the 80s that people remember from MTV. And when Keith Haring is a doormat, like, it's, come on, dude. You're not blowing me away with your art history knowledge because you have
shitty Basquiat, especially Basquiat's like on all this branding now, like all like liquor.
You can get a Basquiat shirt at a Target.
That is absolutely true.
Yeah,
I'm not joking. There's a you can get a Keith Haring doormat, and it's not dope. It's like a wicker doormat with Keith Haring on it, and it's like, what is this? Is what Warhol like talked about is not cool, and you think it's cool means that is so not cool. And that's what Jay-Z is to me. Jay-Z is like someone saying irony is a dead scene, and then Jay-Z walks up and goes, excuse me. I don't dig
it. Someone here says they have a debit card, a Keith Haring debit card. And actually, that's a perfect example of some of these.
Oof.
You know, when I think of like ACT UP and some of the organizations that Keith Haring was working with, I'm just like, ACT UP, like, you know, at the ATM, you know?
As a joke that I got in a lot of trouble for, like even my mom called me, was I was talking about how ridiculous these things are getting. I was like, you're going to see. Was it a Harriet Tubman on a black card, and one of our fans made Harriet Tubman's face on an Amex black card, and that was like the background to the show.
Wow!
And everybody was like, "Jay Snow's a bit too far." I was like, "Dude, really?" I went too far. You wouldn't have put her on a $20 bill. That was like, okay. I put her on an Amex. There's no limit to that spending. What the hell can you get for $20 in America in 2023? I'm trying to say, you know,
the arc of history bends towards justice.
There you go, right there.
Bends towards progress. American Express.
There's someone right now. Someone's talking about. There's someone right now walking around with a Thomas Sankara T-shirt.
Wow.
My 4-year-old son has Che Guevara socks.
Whoa.
Socks.
I didn't buy them. They were handed down from his older cousin.
I need those.
Che Guevara socks.
I need my 4-year-old. Those.
So take that, Jay-Z. Jay-Z, your whole life is Che Guevara socks for 4-year-olds. I hope someone in your camp sends this to you so you can hate me like Killer Mike hates Jared Ball. We actually had serious questions for you today.
I mean, it's already nighttime for me, so like I'm, you know, I can take serious questions, but I also feel like now with this atmosphere, now that I know it looks like I'm incarcerated or something, it
looks frightening. I just want you to know it looks so frightening. Like I have some extra lights. I will mail them to you when I go to the studio.
You know what? Let me turn on another light because it wasn't like this when I started because it wasn't dark.
Now it's going to look like interrogation lights.
Okay.
What time did you buy the bottle of beer? That does not look better. She goes, it's a sunroom. There's no windows in there.
No, there is a window. I'm facing the windows right now.
I'm
watching people drive by and watching the light
reel. Is that what the madman told you to say? Tell him you're facing the window.
Tell him there's a window. Tell him you're right by it.
Oh, my puppy is getting really excited because I'm laughing and she's like trying to jump at me. Violet, do you want to be famous? Do you want to be famous in Mexico?
We can't. Don't even get me started on my dog collection here in Mexico. Even though David Marks claims there is a flattening of taste, there is still an economic barrier. Rich people eat hamburgers, but they're $50 and made with extravagant hand-ground meat on artisanal bread with farm-grown onions. They may look similar, but there's still a massive difference between the elite kish and working-class diner food. Are elites co-opting the look of common when there is still a barrier to be a part of their gang?
Yeah, I think that's actually... So I wrote about this a little bit, but honestly, it could be a whole other essay. Like, the ways in which it's become kind of uncool to consume things that are like clearly markers of elevated taste means that, as you just pointed out, things like fries and burgers are becoming elevated. So, like, you know, you could get pommes frites with aioli that, and they're delicious, that are basically like an elevated form of French fries, because there's a way of like enjoying these things and feeling like somehow you're part of like the hoi polloi, you're part of like, you're not any different than anyone else, when actually you definitely are. And I feel like it's hard to avoid that because it's everywhere. Like, our culture and what our consumer choices are saturated with things that kind of seem really bougie, but are more affordable. But then on the flip side, things that, you know, historically, like burgers and fries, have not seemed bougie at all and are now being made extremely elite and less accessible or less, you know, less available. So I don't know. I just, there's also just like, I mean, I wrote about this a little bit in the piece, but at the exact same time that these markers of taste seem less obvious and that it's easier to kind of seem like you're wealthier than you are as far as dress, as far as like presentation, I think that it's a distraction from the fact that like actual class inequality has like gotten in a lot of cases worse. So, you know, we might look more similar. My dog is literally like,
no, your dog wants to be, your dog's trying to let you out.
She is.
He's trying to let you out.
Your dog is like, freedom awaits. Just go out the door. He's not looking. He's over there tucking his fang in the back. Let's go.
She's so happy to be here now. But in all seriousness, back to what I was saying, like the, I feel like it's a distraction. So I think a lot of times, like, my students often are shocked that like anyone would criticize Patagonia or something like that, or say Patagonia is a class marker. And the thing is, like, Patagonia, I mean, is clearly a class marker. It's expensive stuff. And it doesn't mean it's exclusively a class marker, but it is a class marker. And my students are often so eager to be like, no, this is better for the environment. And this is a better choice. This is more virtuous. This is, you know, this is less damaging. But the thing is, like, what ends up happening then is that, like, this kind of virtuous consumption becomes a different way of, like, signaling your class status. Because somebody who is, you know, actually struggling to, like, pay their rent usually doesn't have the money to prioritize, you know, a jacket that ostensibly is going to save the rainforest. You know, like, I think that there's a lot of ignorance about how what we buy somehow translates into, I guess, being a good person or like being a good consumer, but that's really only true for like wealthy people. So I think that's another thing that's kind of a distraction from like actual inequality. And that's the thing, is like actual inequality is uncomfortable. People don't like to think about actual inequality. Actual inequality is hard to fix. But what isn't hard to fix is, you know, looking like you are you know, classless because no one can actually like pinpoint, you know, how much money you have. Like, that seems like a way to kind of like, you know, address snobbery or address like the cliquishness of the upper classes, but it's not. It's not actually changing, like, you know, people have healthcare, people who don't have healthcare, people who have housing who don't have housing, etc. So I just think there's a way in which like class status, especially when it comes to clothes and knowledge. I mean, clothes are material capital, but I think like embodied knowledge, like I know a lot of people who, you know, could pass for wealthy in terms of like education or knowledge, but don't have the things that they need to actually, you know, live a functioning life. So I felt like that's part of what, I mean, you know, W. David Marks is not interested in writing this like class treatise. I mean, he's writing a book about status and culture. It's a fun book. I mean, if it got really political, at the end, and it would probably get really depressing and the book would be harder to sell. So I can kind of understand why it was maybe more optimistic than I am. But at the same time, there were certain parts I just felt like were too rosy. Like, I think I quoted one part where he said something like, in order to aspire to achieve the world we desire, we have to understand like the intricacies of class and status. And I'm kind of thinking, actually, I don't think we do. Like, you could not understand the intricacies of class and status and still support universal healthcare or still support like housing people who can't afford their ridiculous rents, you know? So, but that stuff is boring. Like, nobody wants to actually talk about like policies that involve numbers and compromise. I mean, it's not as exciting. No.
It's an uncomfortable conversation if you really want to get into the weeds of it, which is why. It's
just people are like, well, I don't know. What can I do? I guess I could, you know, I could get my Patagonia jacket on resale. I can get a used Patagonia jacket.
Yeah. And you saved the world.
That's the thing. It's like, you've done your part. And I'm just like, well, I mean, I'm certainly not a paragon of virtue, and I certainly wouldn't claim to be. I mean, right now I'm, as you know, imprisoned in this yellow
dungeon basement.
With only my puppy for company. So
at least Hannibal Lecter let you have a support dog. So that's, you know, that's, and this is what we're talking about right now with these like signifiers. Like, look, I may be a murderer that will eat you later, but I don't want you whining on the way. Moisturize.
So, I actually think I have some moisturizer in.
You do because if you don't put it on your skin, you will get the hose again.
Hannibal Lecter has gone all woke.
Can I mention something?
Please.
Back to the talk about food and French fries. That's how they got MIA. There was an interview that she did where she ordered French fries, and somehow they end up with truffle oil on them.
Mm-hmm.
Either the reporter suggested it, or they just came with it, or something. But it was reported that she ordered French fries with truffle oil on them.
Oh, yeah.
And she was outed as not being a woman of the people.
Okay. Yeah, no, it was this really snide thing that I totally remember that. It was, mm-hmm. was it Rolling Stone?
I think so.
Yeah. Wow. Basically, like, all of a sudden, MIA is like, you know, she's a traitor because she's enjoying the, you know, truffle oil or the truffle aioli or whatever. And it's kind of like, really? Like, yeah. You know,
That's all it takes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, I'll tell you this right now. You can get some truffle oil at Trader Joe's that has like, you know, 0.0001% truffle, and it's like $4.99.
I thought she was going to say she had a truffle guy. Like
she has her own truffle St. guy. Louis,
well, that is cultural capital. Yeah, I got a guy in Forest Park with a bunch of pigs, and he's just you know,
like, this is a dude. Around. Like Nelly, that's what Nelly's new hustle. He's just, I'm going down, down, baby. Truffle oil.
Yeah, it's getting hot in here because he's smelling
the truffles. It's getting hot in here because of the bootleg truffle oil. I fell off a truck. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? I got all the truffle oil. Sell it to the dame down the street with the dog.
You sound like Bill Cosby right now. You're not doing Nelly.
That is the greatest compliment I ever had in my life. So thank you.
That's hilarious.
To know that I sound like Bill Cosby means I've officially hit.
Well, I'm already kidnapped, so I might as well be doped and drugged as well. So.
Unlike that Bill Cosby, I'm terrified of white women.
As long as you give me a pudding pop first.
Is that what they call it now?
Well, he used to do the Jell-O pudding pop commercials. I love those.
Oh, the innuendo.
Oh, Jason's shirt is Cosby-ish. No, I don't know about that. I don't know if I agree with that. Not,
Bill Cosby would never be caught dead.
No, he wore like a bright sweaters and stuff like that.
I don't have any sweaters.
No.
Mexico. But is some of this talk about cultural capital, does it get us away from something that's becoming almost commonplace, which is... there's a lot more movies about class warfare
Yes.
That's kind of exposing the inequality. I have a problem with them because they generally, for the most part, end with there is no alternative. This is just the way it is. They kind of have bleak endings.
Oh.
But
what are the movies that you're thinking of? Because I think I know what you're talking about.
Snowpiercer kind of ends that way. Parasite kind of ends that way. Joker kind of ends that way. Squid Games, the platform, all these movies that are real popular and everybody gets all excited about it. They definitely, to me, end in a kind of, well, this is just the way it is. And there really is no alternative. There's no communist Superman, you know, saving the day in these stories. Does the conversation, in your opinion, about cultural capital and its significance also kind of help with this narration of why the system in which we live in is the dominant and perfect system?
That's a really good question. So I grapple with this because I love like learning about like fashion and movies and all sorts of aspects of culture that don't have any direct connection to like economic class and class issues. So I love all that stuff. I love writing about that stuff. I like writing about pop culture, but I do sometimes wonder if too much attention directed towards cultural capital and status, sometimes whether or not it has to do with gender identity, sometimes racial identity, sexual orientation, like some of the identity politics that get bound into forms of cultural capital can distract from other types of, from inequality that is a lot more intransigent and hard to tackle. And I think that what's especially dangerous is this idea that things are getting better. So like in 2016, right after Trump was elected, I wrote an essay that was, I actually mentioned it in the Jacobin piece. I wrote an essay called The Pop Culture Progress Myth. And it was really about how, like, as a pop culture critic, I felt like somewhat responsible for totally misconstruing the direction culture was going in and thinking, oh, like, we are just more and more progressive every year. And, you know, I think that right now, for example, that's happening with the Barbie movie. Like, I thought the Barbie movie was really enjoyable and I wrote about it and, you know, but I would never say that, oh, the Barbie movie and its financial success is evidence of like women gaining any kind of parity within filmmaking. Or that, you know, that now, you know, we've reached this kind of feminist epoch because this overtly feminist movie has made so much money. Like, I feel like it's so tempting to indulge the fantasy that when we consume products that seem conspicuously lefty or seem conspicuously feminist or seem conspicuously anti-racist, what have you, that like these cultural things we consume are evidence that things are actually better. And I want to think that's true, but I don't anymore. I don't anymore in the way that I think I used to. So it's not that culture does reflect the realities and does reflect, you know, a lot of the zeitgeist and also influences the zeitgeist. So it's not that I think it's meaningless, but I think that it needs to be, it shouldn't be overvalued. It shouldn't be just taken as its own, as evidence that like, okay, the world is getting fairer and fairer. The world is getting to be a more equal and just place, because I wish that was the case, but I just don't think that it is. And I'm old enough now that I actually feel like, sadly, I've seen enough of the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. So
it's interesting that you say that. The co-host of the show, he has a frat brother that was complaining about the fact that he felt Martha's Vineyard was becoming too normal.
Oh.
Too many normies. And you know, you heard Lula da Silva say that about his time in office, that the elites complained that the airport started to look like bus stations because it became too easy. So many people got lifted out of the poverty and it became, you know, affordable for them to actually fly, and they didn't like it anymore. Mm. And that's interesting, because I do think we live in a moment where you can consume stuff just for you. No one is curating an experience anymore. Even television, you can curate your own experience with, you know, a ton of streaming services, right? Like before, we grew up in the era, even if you had cable, this is why I like so many horrible movies, because I had to watch them as a young person, you know, waiting, you know, Friday the 13th part 7 or whatever. And living in your own curated world, I mean, I'm sure you can believe that there's just so much more for you that a pendulum has shifted, and maybe a pendulum has shifted because conversations are slightly different. You know, I never thought critical race theory would be something we talk about at, you know, this much. But what has really changed when we think about the way we still view things like justice? We have more cities that are run by Black people, mayors, DAs, police chiefs, you know, yet and still you still hear, you know, calls to and you have a Black bourgeoisie in these areas as well, and you still hear calls to, you know, lock people up for longer periods of time. Mm-hmm. As if 1994 never happened. So it is an interesting time in a way where I think visually what we assumed was the norms are changing. Mm-hmm. You know, Wakanda really is forever. Mm-hmm. But bigger than that, you know, what has really changed, you know?
And it's not that I think it's meaningless. Like I said, I do think, like, for example, my students' conversations about gender and sexual orientation are in a lot of ways really exciting in how liberated they seem. I mean, there's so many things I feel like I grew up with in high school and college that were really limiting in the way that I perceived myself and the way that I presented myself to others. And I think all of that, there is progress there. And I think that there's progress even in terms of wealthier students or wealthier people understanding, like, well, I'm from wealth. I have, you know, economic privilege. Like, you know, this is the reality. I do think there's greater awareness of that. And I think that in part might be because of, like, Occupy Wall Street, the, you know, rising awareness of the 1%, the popularity of Bernie Sanders, and a lot of these figures, I think, that have made or destigmatized socialism, or even anything that is a whiff of socialism, ode to socialism, like anything that's even just a tiny little spread, used to be so, you know, it used to be considered so toxic to discourse. And I don't think that's true anymore. And that excites me. I mean, that actually, that fills me with a certain sense of hope. But a lot of times my students who will be presenting themselves as very far to the left have almost no knowledge about, like, economic realities, because those realities are often, I think, dwarfed mm-hmm. by other types of inequality that are splashier, that are more visually oriented. And so I don't know, it's kind of a bummer to be like, well, you actually have to pay attention to this stuff too, because this stuff is less interesting as far as, like, you know, there's more numbers involved. There's a lot of data involved, but, that's great. very good. But I think, but at the same time, you know, I think it's important to do. And I think, I don't know, I think also there's this idea that, like, that I think I mentioned this to you earlier when I was texting with you, like, this idea that the only way to be a virtuous person is to consume virtuously.
Yes.
That's a really bad, that's a dangerous concept to me. Like, I have certainly succumbed to that idea myself, where I'm like, oh, I bought this thing, people saw I bought this thing, and so it's probably makes me look like I'm more conscientious. But I really think that if the way you're defining yourself as being good or virtuous is exclusively or even primarily based on what you consume, that's a bad look. That's not actually the best way to make anything better. But I think people, I understand why people do it, because it's so much easier, because you can just throw money at something. And I also think it's a lot, it's a lot, like, more obvious. Like, the marketing often tells you, like, this is going to make the world a better place, or you're going to, you know, somehow be a better person by buying this thing. And I also just think it's because systemic problems are so hard to really tackle and actually feel like you're making a difference, that people are more likely to just, like, base social justice on buying shit, which is sad.
Well, does that kind of, you know, we're getting up on the hour, and we'll end up this thought. Does that kind of dovetail into this idea? You know, I mentioned to you something I was working on, and you know, I talked about the Bronson Age.
Oh yeah, I love that idea. I thought it was hilarious.
Bronson Age. And the Bronson Age comes about in the what I call the era of the influencer. Mm-hmm. You know, where Warhol mentioned, you know, we'll all be famous for 15 minutes. Now we'll all be, you know, famous for 50 views. right? Because that's the metric on Instagram that lets you know that something you've posted has 50 people liked it. Don't you want to do another thing? So, and this gives us a certain amount of influence over us, our peer group, right? You post a picture of your dog. You're the best dog mom in the world because you, you know, threw your dog a treat. and so that, I think that goes hand in hand with what you're talking about, where being a leftist or even a Trumpist is all about iconography, right?
Oh, yeah. Like, what do you consume?
What do you consume? What books do you have in a bookshelf that you might not even have read? What
I don't have any books because I'm as you know.
It's messed up that it's nice they gave you the dog, but you're like, well, can I just have a book? And he's like, I gave you the internet and the Wi-Fi password. Just use the Netflix that I shared with you, please. Put the lotion in the goddamn basket.
I could have like bookshelves behind me that have all these like, you know, famous theorists or whatever, but I got so tired of that during Zoom because that was a way that people kind of branded themselves as like, look, I'm an academic.
Yeah. Look how cool I am. Look how my books are. And I don't know if you watch certain shows. I mean, I'm talking mainstream shows during that whole Zoom thing during the peak COVID time. I remember seeing sports shows where dudes would place different books every week.
Oh, wow.
It's like, look what I'm reading. It's like, it's all performative. Because we feel we all have an influence. So all we're doing is constantly performing and we're always judged. We also live in a moment where, you know, I can tell you to fuck off, but I can also write fuck off. And then 50 other people will say, yeah, fuck off. And now you feel like the world is telling you to fuck off. And that's a whole different, you know, domino effect of fuckery.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, do you have any other questions? I think we're at the hour, but like...
We're at the hour. And if you are comfortable with going to the champagne room...
I am. I have to go get some bubbly.
Oh, definitely. It's more fun when the guests get drunk. When the guests get drunk, it is so much more ridiculous. And I'm totally excited for that.
Well, I would just want to thank everyone who is like posting their funny comments. I really enjoyed that. It was exactly the kind of like, I don't know, humorous distraction that I... appreciate.
I warned you. Yeah, I warned you.
Yeah, especially like the one about Proust, talking about Proust being its own form of birth control. That was a good one.
That for me was the comment of the day. It was a comment.
It was good. It was really good.
Comment of the day. Was that Bad Lefty? Who left that comment to, Son? Do you remember?
Oh, I didn't see.
You're supposed to keep a track, and then we're going to have comment of the day, and the person's supposed to get a prize.
I was having tech issues.
What is the prize that comment of the day gets from now on, Tucson?
I get to lick from Jean's dog.
Oh, that is gross. Jean's dog is a ball biter.
Jean's dog Domino.
Oh, that's horrible. Actually, you know, our guest is close to Jean Bajelin.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Another person that's part of the show, co-host, and the guy that puts all the thumbnails together is a professor at Missouri State.
Oh, cool.
So we love Missouri.
Oh, yay.
We do.
So thank you very much, Eileen. Wherever you are watching or listening to this show, there are links in the description to Eileen's latest piece in Jacobin entitled Cultural Capital is No Substitute for Cold Hard Cash. Also, gotta know, is New York pizza really all that? Are the bagels really all that?
I think they're pretty good. Like, I love the giant slices you can get for very little. Like, there's just something about that. I mean, speak about, like, egalitarianism. It is actually one of the very few places that still exists in New York where you can actually, like, get something cheap with all different kinds of people there. Yeah, I don't know enough about bagels, but I do like New York pizza. St. Louis pizza is like paper thin, but we have our own style pizza too. Some people like it. I think it's okay. It's like,
I feel like everything you do in St. Louis has Nelly on it.
Oh, I love it.
St. Louis is just, we should watch the video where Nelly swipes his ATM card down that woman's crack. He got in trouble for it.
Early Nelly videos are so, I don't know, they're like of a piece with a specific era.
They are. Yeah.
Dancers in the background and just like, I don't know.
The colors, everything.
I find them to be really good to watch when you're feeling like, you know, extremely depressed because they're they're just, I don't know, like they're so absurd and bright and colorful that I feel like, seriously. The Aston Martin video I also really like for that one. I can't remember.
The uplifting of new videos is a whole new thing that I didn't know existed, and I'm really excited. Steve says San Diego has good pizza. I might be in San Diego. I don't know when, but I need to see if that's
true. Colin says St. Louis pizza is awful. A lot of people hate it. I don't hate it.
I can't remember the last time I ate in the city of St. Louis. Look, we've gone over. We are going to be going in the champagne room.
Okay. Do I click on a different link?
Click on a different link. I will put the link up right now in Patreon because I forgot to do it today. Okay. I forgot. It's my bad. I'm owning it. So go on over to Patreon. The link's coming up. We'll be up in about 5 minutes. Our guest Eileen is going to get good and liquored up. Sadly, we can't play Are You a White Ally with Eileen, but we're going to play another fun game called Jason and MT and Eileen Breakdown Hip-Hop Videos that Jason found on the internet. Okay. So that's always a good time. And that link will be up shortly. Eileen, thank you so much. Tucson.
Oh, you're very welcome. This was fun. Thank you.
What did I tell you? I told you it was going to be fun, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you did.
I thought I was lying?
I was happily pleased. I did not think you were lying. I just wasn't sure what to expect.
I am the Don Cornelius of podcasting. You don't forget it. Tucson, we are
out.